Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
BUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The government has a long way to go to improve homeland security. Intelligence failures before 9/11 and now daily terrorist attack warnings are reminders of how vulnerable this country remains. But is it local governments who have the most work to do? We begin tonight in New York, where security and nerves have tightened after warnings of a vague and so far uncorroborated threat against the Brooklyn Bridge and Statue of Liberty. Police and city officials are urging the public to go about their daily business. Dan Barry is a reporter with the New York Times, and earlier I asked if New Yorkers were heeding the call and to describe the mood in the city.
People are a little jittery, but some of the cause of the jitteriness is because we can't tell what's real and what's not, whether there's a legitimate threat out there or yet another in what has been a series of vague, unspecific threats. It comes in a context of what's occurring in Washington. The Bush administration, and particularly the FBI, are under some criticism for not having perhaps acted quickly upon some information they received in the weeks preceding September 11th and the terrorist attacks of that day. On Monday, the FBI notified a joint terrorism task force here in New York that a detainee, an Al-Qaeda detainee, had been sharing some information. And one of the things this detainee said was that city landmarks in New York were being targeted or had been targeted for attack. And the information that we received was that specifically the reference was to either the Brooklyn Bridge or Statue of Liberty.
Now, Dan Barry, this is interesting. Do we know when the detainee said this? Do we know when he thought these attacks might occur? Do we know how credible a statement this might be? Any sense of any of those things?
First, I think the information is fairly fresh. I think that there was a sense of urgency on the part of the FBI to get it to New York as soon as possible. But then again, there are critics in New York who are saying that the FBI and the Bush administration perhaps are ginning up with the kind of information they've been receiving all along, given that they're getting some bad press down in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But the specifics of that information are very, very vague. No sense of timing, no sense of method, really nothing other than this report. And the FBI and the NYPD, the New York City Police Department, stress that the credibility of this information hasn't really been assessed.
This comes at a time when you'll have Fleet Week coming up with 21 naval ships in the harbor there, 6,000 sailors in town. What extra security measures are New York authorities taking?
There had been preparations for heightened security because of Fleet Week. The Coast Guard, for example, had already taken some measures to make sure that no vessels came near any of the military ships. But given this information, the New York police got involved to a much more visible extent. Beyond having patrol boats out around Liberty Island, upon which sits the Statue of Liberty, beyond that, they've increased security at all the major, or most of the major, bridges and tunnels leading into Manhattan Island, and specifically focusing on the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge.
How are they exercising that security with that enormous flow of traffic? What are they looking for? Who do they stop? What have the consequences been?
They're trying to be sensible about this. They're not trying to overreact. And they are adjusting with full knowledge that this is a vague, vague threat. They are at the tolls, at the entrances, and they're eyeballing all the cars that pass by. When they see a car that catches their interest, they pull it over. And sometimes it's merely just asking a few questions and then waving the car on. Other times, particularly with the vans, they're pulling them off to the side of the road and doing a more intensive search of the van.
And for a while today, the bridge itself was shut down. That, I guess, hasn't happened since 9/11 and before that. I don't know when.
One of one of the reasons that people perhaps are jittery in New York is that there is this the resurrected feelings that were throughout the city in the first weeks and months after the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. I don't think it's reached that level, obviously. I mean, the city of New York at that time was pretty much in a lockdown state, but it's quite unusual to have the Brooklyn Bridge shut down for security checks.
What's the range of responses you're hearing to this, Danbury? Do New Yorkers feel manipulated? Do they feel jerked around? Or do they feel, well, we have to do this to try to be secure?
Well, jerked around, that sounds like kind of a New York term, but I think that it really runs the gamut. I mean, if you look at the covers of the two tabloids in New York today, one is an impassioned editorial by the New York Post in which they quote FDR, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." That's the wood, that's the headline. And in the Daily News, there's a reference to, you know, Brooklyn Bridge and Lady Liberty under attack or being targeted. And then a big takeout on whether Mike Piazza, the Mets catcher, is gay. He adamantly denies that he's gay. I think that that kind of reflects that, you know, it's all over the lot. Some people are annoyed because what do you do? As one fellow said, what are you supposed to do with this information? How are you supposed to go about your daily life thinking that you're constantly under attack? So I think it's in the back of many people's minds, but there's really not much they can do. It's not like suddenly there's been a spike in citizens' arrests or anything, you know?
And yet, as vague as it is, we clearly hear the fear of real economic consequences.
Oh, absolutely. This kind of publicity is not the kind of publicity that New York seeks, particularly after 9/11. I think there was a little while there when no one really wanted to come to New York, and it's still, with documentaries on television about 9/11, it's still very fresh in everyone's minds. And so then to have these uncorroborated, vague threats out there as part of the buzz of New York, it doesn't help. And I think Fleet Week is a big tourism week, so, and it's supposed to be a nice weekend, so it is a big deal, yes.
You quote a psychologist walking across the bridge saying, to live in New York now, you have to have a certain sense of denial.
Yes, I know that. And there is a sense that, okay, whenever you're on a subway or whenever you're on a bridge, that, you know, why not now? Why not?
You mean why wouldn't something terrible happen now and here and now?
We've already seen it. I think it's very fresh in people's minds, you know, looking south from Midtown Manhattan and seeing the smoke rising from what had been the World Trade Center. That's very, very fresh. Mm-hmm. So the woman is correct in a sense that you have to live with a sense of denial. But on the other hand, denial is part of everyday life in a large city because there's always the vague threat of fear.
You could always be hit by the bus.
You could always get hit by the bus, right. I probably will after this conversation.
Danbury, thanks very much for joining us.
All right. You take care. Thank you.
Danbury is a reporter with the New York Times. He joined us from his office in New York. Former House Speaker Tip O'Neill once said that all politics is local. Should the same be said for Homeland Security? If this country is waiting for Tom Ridge to shoulder the terrifying burden, tonight's guest, former Army Colonel and security guru David McIntyre, says we might as well be waiting for Godot. Don't wait for Washington, he warns. It's time for local and private leaders to get busy. Time to roll up their sleeves. Time to roll out the cash and make the shopping malls, schools, and businesses safer. Do you buy it? Is this country expecting too much from the federal government? Will terror be stopped closer to home? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, is David McIntyre. He's deputy director of the Answer Institute for Homeland Security and a retired colonel from the U.S. Army. Good evening and welcome, David McIntyre.
Thanks, sir. Good to join you.
It's good to have you with us. So you say if we're waiting for Washington to solve and fight the terrorist problem, we're waiting for Godot. What do you mean by that, David McIntyre?
Well, 2 points. The first has to do specifically with this administration, which has not had a proclivity toward large federal programs. I think Governor Ridge has said several times in speeches, I'm just not sure everyone has been listening, that it's not their intention to build a Social Security Administration or an EPA or Department of Education sort of program and leave that behind in the form of Homeland Security. They have taken a different approach, which is to provide guidelines, guidance, some seed money, some federal standards, and to expect the state governors and the local officials to have a larger hand in their own security.
But they've been very pro-national security. Isn't this about national security?
Well, of course it is. However, National security and homeland security are going to be quite different in this regard. We are used to the national security framework where we all collect our money. It goes to a central location. We buy one kind of tank. We buy one kind of fighter plane, and it's sent overseas. Homeland security is going to be quite different from that just because we're organized differently. First of all, politically, the President of the United States cannot tell the governor of Louisiana how to distribute the state police in Louisiana. Governor Ridge cannot give an order and have a deputy sheriff in Oklahoma take it. So we've got to have a different method for how we organize for homeland security. Secondly, economically, our whole system is built around the incentive program. We do not have a command economy. And so to try to turn around and build a command homeland security program that says one size fits all, it's just not the way our country operates.
Speaking of ways that our country doesn't operate, though, this notion of local security from what is in many senses an external threat or even an internal threat, this seems really alien to American cities, towns, and states. I mean, there's this Al-Qaeda. It's a global network. They're talking about nuclear weapons, about biological weapons.
Right.
This doesn't jibe, in my mind, at first blush, with how Americans imagine themselves fighting this global threat.
I think you're exactly right. We are, in many respects, in a new world. Two points I would make to you. First is that in homeland security, we are in many respects the same way that national security was in about 1953. We suddenly had a war that had ended the way we hadn't anticipated. We could see we were going to have a global threat for a long time. It had the survival of the nation was at stake. And yet we didn't have any of the schools like the Kennedy School. We didn't have any of the concepts like how to fight a nuclear war. We didn't have the Strategic Air Command. We had none of the intellectual framework for how to put the Department of Defense was brand new. We had none of the intellectual framework for how to think about this global war. And that's kind of where we are in Homeland Security. It is going to take us a decade, maybe more, to build the academic disciplines, to build the university routines that help us to understand the most economical, the best way to approach this issue. The second point I'd make quickly, though, is this. Homeland Security is infinitely expensive. Infinitely. It is impossible for us to make ourselves perfectly secure. And that's especially true when someone else is paying the bill. And consequently, if we all look to the federal government, then we're going to get a policeman on every school bus. We're going to have metal detectors at every convenience store.
Why will the federal government make it more expensive?
Why would the federal government? It's because the money doesn't look like it comes from you. It looks like there's some big pot of money that we're drawing from. And that is simply not the case. There is an infinite demand for a free good, I think is the way an economist would put it. And so what we're going to have to do, I think, is institute some discipline to the system. We're going to have somebody accountable, and not just at the federal budget level.
That sounds like an HMO approach to national security.
Well, I wouldn't use that comparison, but I would tell you that I think university officials are going to have to bear some responsibility for their own planning. You can't depend on someone in the federal government at Washington, D.C. to design the plan for your sports stadium, for your schools, for what to do if there seems to be some sort of attack against your bridges. The problem is this, and this is really important. There is a difference between preparing for an emergency like a hurricane or a tornado and preparing for a thinking enemy. You see, whatever you do to protect yourself, I'm going to attack some other way.
So, but your message is striking me as mixed. Are we talking about sandbags around City Hall here or
no.
Give up because we can't possibly afford to close all the holes?
No, that's not true. What I'm proposing to you is that somebody's got to prioritize. Now, we should certainly look for the federal government for those things, as always, that only the federal government to do. It would be ridiculous to ask a city to develop a vaccine program. The federal government needs to work on that. The federal government's going to have to be involved in radiation detection. However, when you talk about other threats, how do you prioritize the thousands of bridges in this country? How do we decide what kind of sensors and monitors you have going into buildings around the United States? I'm just trying to tell you that a central location trying to prioritize every skyscraper in the United States is just going to be another command economy. We know how those work. Local officials are going to have to bear part of the burden. I think the figure Governor Ridge has suggested, or at least his office suggested, is roughly a one-third, two-thirds distribution of the cost. That is, about a third would come out of the federal budget targeted, and maybe about two-thirds from state, local, and private industry.
David McIntyre, stand by. You're bringing it local is making it all too real. We're looking at the local costs of fighting terrorism. where and what they may be on a day when the Brooklyn Bridge has been searched and traffic has been stopped, when there are patrol boats around the Statue of Liberty, when schools have been afraid of neighborhood approaches by Middle Eastern men. Does it mean that the war against terror is going to the local level? Are Americans expecting too much of federal government? Does counterterrorism have to go local? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the local phase of counterterrorism, about getting real block by block in the war on terror. Is the country psychologically resistant to making the war on terrorism local? Are we politically ready for this? Can state and local governments afford to fight a local war on terrorism? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by David McIntyre. He's deputy director of the Answer Institute for Homeland Security, a retired Army colonel. David McIntyre, make this real for us. Give us a case, I guess a kind of case study or example. If you're a town or a city and you want to step up, in your view, what does taking responsibility or being ready in the war on terrorism mean at the local level?
Sure. Let me offer you first a quick metaphor, and that would be the interstate highway system. The federal government works with state governments to determine the routes and the cities that should be connected and the exact paths that those highways should travel. The federal government sets standards for how much concrete, the thickness, the rebar steel that goes into it, the sweep of curves, the height of bridges. And it provides a large amount of federal money toward building the federal interstate highway system.
And the terror equivalent of all that is, or the counterterror?
Well, a number of things that only the federal government can do, addressing biological warfare, for example, or securing the borders through the INS, or providing intelligence through the FBI and the CIA. However, if your local city wants more than the interstate highway system, if you want more bridges and more roads, well, you pony up for those yourself. In that respect, if you want your malls, your local malls, to have some sort of filtering system in the air handling equipment that's going to catch particulate matter and might catch some biological pathogen, well, you're going to have to pony up for that yourself.
You know, I can't help but see the logic in that. Just here in the Boston area, in the last day or two, there were warnings in a local Boston suburb, Brookline, about men of Turkish origin casing the schools, fear of terror, talk of new police assignments. It turned out that they were just looking for schools for their kids.
Right.
But at that moment, those towns in that area were thinking, how are we going to respond to this? You know, these are towns with police departments that are already strapped, that are doing tax limitation overrides to try and keep their schools going. How on earth can local towns pick up the cost of fighting terror that could come from any direction?
You're absolutely right. That is one of the major differences, by the way, between police and fire departments and the military. The military has a huge reserve. When it is not in war, it is planning and training. But there's no reserve for your police and fire departments. They are always at war. They are fully committed every day. There are very few of them available for planning and training.
So what the heck do you do when the terrorists come to town?
Well,
or you fear they might?
What you do is, first of all, we're not going to solve this by next Tuesday morning. It's just not going to be solved overnight. We are going to have to work our way through intellectually this problem. Secondly, you prioritize on a local level. You hold your local officials responsible and not just the federal officials. You say, look, how much have we spent on security, and what did you do with it? Did we have some exercises? Were they successful? I mean, this is a tremendous opportunity for Americans to become re-involved at the local level with their own government and to make some decisions where they can see a result. I think you ought to be asking in mayoral races, how much money did we spend, and was it well spent?
You know, this all may be just coming to grips with reality, but it also has an old flavor that I recall of duck and cover nuclear phobia, of vigilance sounding potentially too much like vigilante. I mean, how small a level do we have to take this down to? Are we talking about, you know, I joked about sandbags at City Hall, but are we, you know, walls around every house, trenches at the outskirts of town? I mean, is it possible to get overwrought here?
It's a really good question, and I think you're exactly right. Sometimes I just want to grab everybody around me and say, let's breathe into a bag here and calm down. Yeah, the Israelis offer us a good example. There are people that have been under attack on a daily basis year in and year out, and their economy works. They have sporting events. Their people go to schools. They get married. They have children. They have families. We can do the same thing. It's not necessary for us to overreact. It is necessary that we understand we live in a new world, and we're going to have to be alert to those kinds of threats. Now, I'm from Texas, and there's an old tradition in Texas that goes back 150 years that if you have a problem, you look first to your local neighbor. After that, you look to the local law enforcement. Then they call the county sheriff. Then maybe the state police. Boy, it's got to be really bad before the federal government shows up. I think we're going to see ourselves in this area kind of moving back to that model, which is much more community-based. There are a lot of advantages to that.
There's a lot that comes with that package, though, politically at the local level. Texas justice calls a whole range of things to mind, not all of them perfect virtue. And apart from that, what on earth does a local town do about, the bioterror in its drinking water that comes from a reservoir 100 miles away?
Well, you might be surprised. I could have used Vermont or New Hampshire. They have that kind of tradition of local self-help as well. I just happen to be from Texas. But let me tell you that there are a large number of first responder schools. Now, I talked about the federal government taking the lead in some areas, and a large amount of the money that was put aside for Homeland Security this year went to first responder schools. There are a number of them scattered around the countryside that work with firemen, policemen, emergency medical technicians. Those people are receiving training by the thousands. I know that here in Washington, D.C., we have 17 different governments in this area, and they could go in 17 directions. Instead, they formed a council of governments, and they have some coordinated training. They've coordinated their frequencies and their responses. They have had chemical training. They have purchased chemical suits. Now, it's important that we as taxpayers make sure they're not wasting the money. On the other hand, if they're wisely investing it, then we ought to reward those elected officials. We don't want to be hysterical. You are absolutely right. What we do want to do is recognize that this is, A, a genuine threat, and, B, a thinking enemy. It's not like preparing for a hurricane. And what that means is, for a long time, we're going to have to find a way to protect ourselves and our families without turning against our neighbors. And I think we can only do that through cooperation beginning, not ending, but beginning at the local level.
Gosh, it's been comforting to think of this as being solved in Washington. David McIntyre, stand by. I want to welcome in Phil Anderson. He's Director of Homeland Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good evening and welcome, Phil Anderson.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. Phil, you've been listening to this conversation. You've heard David McIntyre's argument for driving the war on terrorism local as quickly and effectively as possible. Are there points here at which you'd see a yellow caution light?
No, for the most part, I agree with Dave, but there's a couple of points that need to be considered. One is, the most important point is, if you look at 9/11, who responded to that crisis?
New York's finest, of course.
That's right, and Arlington County here in Virginia at the Pentagon. It makes perfect sense that state and local governments and first responder, public health, public safety, organizations need to take responsibility in this environment. I think the problem, the biggest problem, lies in who's going to pay for it.
Where will the money come from? Everyone seems to be strapped and more than strapped already.
Well, and I think you're exactly right. I think that's evident. And if you look at state and local homeland security efforts, at this point in time, while some are doing a little bit better than others, by and large, they're very understaffed, very underfunded. It's a low priority in relation to the numerous other requirements that they have at the state and local level. They just don't have the money.
So where does it come from? If you're saying it took New York's finest to respond to 9/11, that suggests very muscular security services in every town and city in America. It's hard to picture, frankly.
Yeah, New York's not a good example. New York is absolutely the exception. You're talking about the best organized, best equipped, best manned, best funded police department on the face of the planet.
So what's Hooterville supposed to do?
Well, therein lies the problem. There's a lot that can be done in the absence of funding. A lot can be done today to improve the situation.
Such as?
Well, what we've got to do in this environment is we've got to expand situational awareness. That doesn't cost a lot of money. We need to take a risk management approach to this problem, and we need to look very closely at the threat. And, you know, it isn't that hard to get at the nature of the threat. We need to look at vulnerabilities, and each and every state and local, each city, each area, region out there has its own specific vulnerabilities. We need to look at countermeasures. We need to identify those things. We need to look at existing capabilities. We need to identify shortfalls. That can all be done within the existing structure and the existing budget.
I don't
think it's being done, and I think that that's unfortunate. But
does this mean turning America into some kind of armed camp right down to the local level? Or does getting real about terrorism mean that we have to have it, you know, top of mind all the time and every local agency attuned to it?
Well, there's a little bit of both of those things that we need to be doing in this new environment. We can't be consumed by this, by the threat and the likely possibilities and terrorist attack scenarios. I mean, it can't consume our lives, but we certainly need to be cognizant of all of the possibilities. And there are numerous possibilities out there.
We've heard that, but somehow we didn't imagine the city fathers, the town council, having to take them all on. Phil Anderson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Phil Anderson is director of the Homeland Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bruce is on the line. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I'd like to, to some extent, challenge the underlying premise of this show that...
Go for it.
...that defending the homeland is actually possible. Now, I know in terms of military strategy, the defensive position is always a very weak position, and that's talking in terms of two clashing armies.
Mm-hmm.
But whereas when you have terrorists who are attacking an area the geographic size of the U.S., I just don't – the idea of homeland defense strikes me as one of the most absurd concepts I've ever heard of. How are we going to defend this territory?
Bruce, how literally do you mean that? I mean, people have been really upset the last few weeks that the word of, Middle Eastern men training at the Phoenix flight schools was not passed on to the FBI. Are you saying so what?
No. Well, that I think buttresses my argument. We spend, by some accounts, $30 to $40 billion on intelligence, and apparently that wasn't good enough to alert us to that threat. But at any rate...
Okay, so what's your response then to the threat?
Well, I don't completely disagree with greater vigilance, but at the same time, essentially what's driving this terrorism is fury among a lot of the Islamic world at the U.S., mm-hmm. So I wonder, shouldn't we be reexamining those U.S. policies, which are generating so much animosity? And I would agree that it's not all our fault, but we've played a major part in it.
So you're saying let's take it to the foreign policy agenda and figure it out there. Bruce, thanks for your call. David McIntyre, how do we get close to the right balance here? Obviously, there's work to be done in the U.S. interaction with the world.
Right.
At the same time, you're talking about, you know, the town next door and City Hall down the street.
Right. And the caller's right on a couple of points there. The first is the point that this is a attack from overseas is not solved domestically. We cannot have perfect security. That's one of the reasons we need help prioritizing, starting with the local level. The problem is generated overseas. It must be addressed overseas. And deterrence is not a matter simply, but deterrence is not a matter simply of striking them. It's also of demonstrating to them that they're not going to achieve their objective. Now, I would suggest to you that Mayor Giuliani and the citizens of New York City did us all a great service in the way they responded, because they denied the terrorists their objective. You didn't get a big panic. You didn't get people terrified and horrified and unable to respond. What you saw was a great city responding in a great fashion. That does help to deter the attacks. But he's right that the problem is overseas. Very quickly, if I may, one other point, though, and that is I'd suggest we need to think really hard about the issue of intelligence failure. A quick history lesson going back through our wars would demonstrate to you that starting with the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, the sinking of the Lusitania, the attack of the Japanese, the attack of Hitler, the attack of the North Koreans, and the Chinese joining that, Tet the attack in the Gulf.
Okay, what's
Somalia,
the common thread?
They all start with surprise. What that tells you is the caller is right, that surprise is almost impossible to protect against. So our intel has to give us more than just, is it going to happen this afternoon?
Mm-hmm. But gosh, getting the right balance in this response.
Very hard.
I want to bring in right now Mayor Scott King. He's mayor of Gary, Indiana. Good evening and welcome, Mayor King.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening in on this conversation. What do you think? As David McIntyre says, towns, cities, stand up and protect thyself in many dimensions. Does that sound like a reasonable expectation to you?
Well, towns and cities throughout the United States do that every day, did it well before September 11th. However, what's being defined now is a non-domestic threat to the towns and the cities.
Mm-hmm.
It's been labeled with the moniker war in Washington, not in Gary. And the whole notion that, gee, guys, you know, you're on your own, if that's being suggested, either financially or in terms of developing an appropriate protocol, I think is and respectfully, I just think that's a really misguided notion. The truth of the matter is that beginning with the sharing of information, mm-hmm. which after September 11th, the mayors and the police chiefs throughout this country discovered was just simply in an absolutely ranging from non-existent to abysmal state.
Mm-hmm. We've seen that.
Was the first issue we took on. And we engaged with the Department of Justice. We engaged with specifically the FBI and learned in that process, for example, that as of September 11th, the FBI and the Justice Department in the same Department of Government couldn't communicate electronically one with the other because they had incompatible email systems.
But Mayor King, take us right down to Gary, Indiana. David McIntyre is saying you've got to be ready to do more to defend yourself and to respond in case of terrorism. Do you have the capacity in Gary, Indiana to do more? How much more can you do?
Well, you know, we are on the response side. We have to respond in a wide variety of circumstances, including the threat from post-September 11th. For example, our airport, and we're very close to Chicago, our airport was one of the first in the Chicagoland area to reopen because, without waiting for instructions from headquarters, we sent our SWAT and other police resources there to provide a level of security that the FAA passed on more quickly than other airports. We were able to get it reopened. However, we can't simply be about the business, though, of responding after the fact. In some cases, the anthrax situation is a very classic example. I mean, respond how? What's the protocol? We cannot anticipate training every one of our officers, every one of our public safety personnel on every possible permutation of the threat unless we're getting some accurate and reliable intelligence and information sharing from the federal government.
Mayor King, we have to take a short break. Can you hang with us for just a minute?
Yeah.
We're talking about the local face of counterterrorism tonight, about getting real block by block in the war on terror. Are Americans expecting too much of the federal government in this war? Does counterterrorism have to go local? What does it mean if it does? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about getting real locally, block by block, in the war on terror. We're joined by David McIntyre. He's deputy director of the Answer Institute for Homeland Security, and by Scott King, mayor of Gary, Indiana. Do we risk leaving the war on terror to the least equipped arms of government? Can we get real in the war on terror without getting local? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Mayor King, David McIntyre has said that if you look at the Bush administration and think about what you see, that you should quickly come to the conclusion that they're not likely to build a big new federal initiative, even in the interest of counter-terror work, that it's going to be states and localities who have to deal with it. Does that leave you feeling a little bit naked?
Well, semi-clothed, perhaps. I mean, again, because day in, day out, all you know, any sort of threat, be it natural disaster, be it criminal activity, whatever, we have to deal with on a regular basis. But, and using the natural disaster analogy, you know, to advocate that, gee, you're and on your own strategy, and I don't want to overstate Mr. McIntyre's point, but to advocate that position, well, then let's undo FEMA. Let's undo the national weather warning system on the information side, and then take it all the way down during and post-disaster in terms of the response, and not offer the federal assistance when a local community, a very tiny community in some circumstances, gets devastated by natural disaster. I mean, and that's why I don't think you need to totally create some new bureaucratic monster. I think, frankly, I have been, and I've had the occasion on more than one time to be at the table with former Governor Ridge. I think the approach he's taken would be described by mayors throughout the country as being reasoned and rational. Maybe it's not every piece we want, but it has moved in the right direction in terms of the manner of warning. You know, he's chosen a color coding sort of system,
right,
but mainly how they share the information, unlike what the vice president did on Sunday or the FBI director thereafter.
So just the arm waving.
Well, it's, you know, it's just, gee, you know, we're back to September 12th. Mm-hmm. I mean, but the other piece was using his proposal is to use the FEMA model and use, in fact, FEMA in order to move from Washington to state capitals to metro to county level.
So the model of federal emergency management.
Yes.
Maybe
and
that'll do it.
And you don't have to reinvent and create a new agency to accomplish it. But you've got to provide some funding resources, and you've got to provide information, and you've got to provide training, and that's got to come. That leadership's got to come from Washington.
And that alone
if
is a lot.
I think the mayor and I are more in agreement than disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
Virtually every point that he's laid out I would agree with, and I think his example of opening his airport is exactly what I'm talking about when I say local leadership has to step forward. That's just what he's done. And FEMA is a great example. However, the funding that he talked about after a disaster, there is a difference between that and a large amount of funding before the disaster.
There sure is, especially when you lay it on nationwide. Scott King, I know we have to let you go. I want to thank you for joining us. Scott King is mayor of Gary, Indiana. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to turn to our phones. They're crammed with people who want to join us. Kathleen is on the line. Welcome, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just think that the idea of homeland security is difficult to deal with.
It sure
it
is.
It makes sense to me. I find this whole topic very worrisome. The problem is a national one, a foreign policy error, and until we address the kind of empire that we're building overseas, we're not going to be safe at home. People are going to hate us throughout the world. There's no way to do it. I'm not going to question my neighbors, worry if they have darker skin than I am. This is ridiculous. We can't do this until we clean up the mess abroad.
But what about the immediate problem, Kathleen?
The immediate problem? Well, okay, why don't you look at our policy in Israel? Why don't you look at our policy with the Palestinians? That, to me, is how to address the issue.
So you want to look abroad again, and your concern is that if we instead focus on the war on terror at home, it will just mess up America.
Absolutely. 1950s. You know, the war on terrorism is kind of, what is that? What does that mean? It doesn't mean much to me other than we've got some real foreign policy disasters and people are angry with us. And checking out whether my neighbor might be Middle Eastern is not the solution.
Kathleen, thanks for your call. David McIntyre, there you hear again the voice of the listener saying, hey, wait a minute. It doesn't sound like this is someone who's ready to step up and pass a new big budget for doubling the police force.
I think that's probably right. Right, but I would suggest there are a number of things that can be done in her community that would probably satisfy her, where you get what I guess you would call a twofer, a double effect, and that is that if you train your fire department to work against chemical weapons, they are very well trained then to deal with a tank car that derails and has a chemical release. If you deal with you increase your public health service to deal with some sort of a biological attack, then you are in much better shape if you have some sort of a natural occurrence and an outbreak.
But there are these many interesting political and psychological layers here of resistance to this. Some, I suppose, just we don't want to think about the possibility of being attacked at the local level every day. The other, very legitimately political, saying, hey, if we put all the emphasis on this, what about other issues that lie behind this threat?
Hey, I wouldn't disagree with that.
That's why I keep coming back to additional power down. If the listener feels that way, then she needs to vote and be engaged with her local, state, and federal officials. And that's the way. If she feels that way, that's the way to bring the world around to her point of view. But we don't do it by saying I want to be defended. I need a large national centralized program. Mm-hmm. And whether that's right or wrong, my point is I just don't think that's going to happen.
We're talking about the local face of counterterrorism. Judith is on the line. Welcome, Judith. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I lived in Israel between 77 and 87.
Okay.
And, you know, you've had a lot of programs that were connected to what's happening in the Middle East now, and I hear some of the callers speaking to the political side, but that's already been covered a lot of times, and I actually want to bring it back to really local and actually to individual citizens because...
So you want to think about security where you live?
What do you mean?
I'm sorry, but you're saying let's get off the big world stage for a second and look at the security issues that are local.
Right. Only in the sense that in living there for 10 years, mm-hmm. I got used to it was a matter of course that, you know, you didn't let things go unattended, like no packages were left unattended. You didn't leave them. And if you saw one that was unattended, you let somebody know about it. You know, you were used to having to go through some sort of searching when you went into a major building or a public institution, and the airport security was obviously excellent.
And this was long before the kind of intifada we've seen in the last year and a half.
Yes, it was, because there were still dangers of bombs and mm-hmm. of attacks of one another, of Katyusha attacks and things.
Judith, what's your sense of how much America would have to change to begin to approximate that level of security awareness?
Well, I think that the focus was really in the wrong direction. In as soon as September 11th happened, the first thing I thought of was, well, what do you expect with such lousy airport security? From the time I came back to the United States, all of those years, people could hear me whining about how unsecure the airports really were, and I think that was something that where they really let the ball drop.
So you're saying just go with basic good sense about security,
right? And to tell everybody every time that there's some sort of warning or they have some sort of inkling that something's going to happen to a bridge or, you know, the banks are going to be attacked or downtown Boston is going to have an attack. I think that, you know, I have nothing really to say about what the infrastructure needs to do. I don't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. And probably those are the people who need to know about things like that. To tell the general population isn't really helpful.
Judith, thanks for your call. I want to put it to David McIntyre, the same question, David. People have raised the model of Israel for perhaps the kind of security awareness that Americans in America need to have now. How big a change would that mean in American culture?
I'm not sure we could make that change. I think there are a lot of lessons that we can learn from Israel, but I'm not sure we could become Israel. I think we are our own nature, and we're going to have to do what is successful in our organization, the way we're organized within our country. Your caller that was concerned about being suspicious of the neighbors and being a country that constantly watches one another, I think that's a valid concern. A lot of Americans would be worried about that. But we can be, as your last caller suggested, mm-hmm. a nation that watches out for each other. It's not the same thing.
And you've also said that private companies need to do more in the counter-terror effort. What do you mean there?
Well, they're going to have to make some basic decisions about, for example, building security, building design, what kind of buildings they want to be located in, where they want their parking garages to be in the future. They're going to have to think about recovery plans. Now, that's not something we've really had as a mindset, but they need to think about a recovery plan. For example, I was working with a university recently, and they were worried about what happens if they need to shut down the school 3 weeks before finals. How would they recover that last 2 or 3 weeks of the semester in order to launch the next semester on time? Well, that's something we haven't really focused on in the past.
Do we have the capacity to do that and live life as we've known it, or at least close to that, to add this new thick layer of planning for all these contingencies and still get along?
I think we do. I think that we do because you don't have to respond. You don't have to plan for every contingency. The military doesn't plan for every contingency. The military plans for a few and then trains. Now, that is something we haven't done in the past that we are going to have to do more of. And that is one way in which our life is going to have to change. The police, the fire, the emergency rooms, the hospitals, universities, even offices probably ought to practice a fire drill occasionally in a way that maybe they didn't in the past. We do need to exercise, but we don't have to plan for everything, secure ourselves. We're not talking about armoring the door. We're just talking about, as you said earlier, applying good common sense.
But it sounds like some kind of return here to duck and cover exercises. Mel is on the line. Welcome, Mel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'll try to be quick. I think the references to the model of Israel, where you can have a working economy and still have a heightened sense of at the home level security,
though a suffering economy right now.
Right. It's like the problem is that I don't really think it's viable. It's not really proved as a solution because despite all that, they still have terrorist attacks, that suicide bombings, and it hasn't solve the problem. So, your original statement entering the program is, can you stop terrorism at the home, hometown level? No, you can't, because it hasn't been stopped if it reaches there. You can only stop it at its source. And, so I don't think it's a problem. I think you can and should take measures in accordance with, like, the FEMA standard model, where you are going to, everybody, universities should consider plans for contingencies, because disasters and events happen regardless of terrorism. But I think you have to be careful about instilling a culture of, hometown, local terrorist defense, because there's a danger of instilling a culture of paranoia. And also, of course, the danger of cost, which is, the financial cost could be enormous.
Mel, thanks for your call. David McIntyre, how about it? It does still bring to mind this kind of incongruous image of Officer Barney Fife grappling with a terror squad down by the levee, trying to keep the bioweapon out of the drinking water.
The world, we keep saying the world has changed, and then we go back to work as though it hadn't.
Well, we are schizophrenic on this point. We agree.
we're going to have to decide that whether we like it or not, there are some new elements at play in the world. And your caller is exactly right that even with a lot of security, some people are going to get through. However, the bad news and good news together is there are a lot of things we can do to deter attacks. That's the good news. The bad news is you never know when you deterred one. We put a lot of effort into the Olympics, and we had no event whatsoever. We've put a lot of effort into the last few months, and we've had no event. Will we eventually get another event? Yes, we probably will. If we determine that that's a failure, well, then we might as well give up right now. Here's a fact for you. Mm-hmm. Between now and a week from now, probably somewhere around 250, 300 Americans are going to die on the highways.
Okay.
We don't all park our cars. We learn to live with it.
But we sure don't have the resources to turn every American town and city into Salt Lake City Olympics time.
Right. We have to prioritize. We have to decide how much level of risk we're willing to live with, and then we have to pay up to that level. And it's in some areas the federal government can provide the money. The mayor used an excellent example with anthrax. Certainly the federal government's going to have to sort out what do you need to do in case of an anthrax exposure, what kind of drugs, how many drugs, and so forth. However, when the federal government delivers what they call the push package, and there is one, a package that could go to a town of antibiotics and just be delivered, the federal government has designed that. But when it gets there, who takes that tons of pills and breaks it into little bottles and gets it out to people who need it? That's going to have to happen at the local level. You're not going to get thousands of federal employees to show up to do that. So that's what I'm talking about when I say we can mix these two things. By the way, if you think through it, that doesn't all have to be done by the police. It could be done by Rotarians. It could be done by church groups. What we have to do is think about ahead of time how to organize ourselves on short notice in order to support our neighbors. And that's doable.
It's really, I hear you. It sounds like hearkening back to an older time, truly to a war time, in a way that we haven't quite got our heads around yet. David McIntyre, Deputy Director of the Answer Institute for Homeland Security, thank you for joining us tonight. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.